Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Floating in the Deep End, How Caregivers Can See Beyond Alzheimer's, by Patty Davis, narrated by Christina Delane. Foreword by Mary Catherine Mayo, M.D. In writing Floating in the Deep End, and before that in bringing into being Beyond Alzheimer's, a support group for caregivers, Patty Davis has taken an incredibly difficult personal experience and galvanized it into a years-long mission to provide knowledge, support, guidance, and reassurance to Alzheimer's caregivers. As a caregiver for her father, she did extensive work and research in the care of Alzheimer's patients and learned a great deal of practical knowledge. She also tapped into the specific needs and challenges faced by those providing care to Alzheimer's patients, including their important spiritual journey. I had the privilege of being a part of Beyond Alzheimer's as a co-facilitator with Patty, and was frequently awed by her kindness, humor, and compassion. There is a saying in medicine, "See one, do one, teach one." The phrase typically refers to learning a procedure and then passing along this knowledge, but it comes to mind here as well. Through her insight and perspective, Patty provides guidance, reassurance, and a sense of connection to others experiencing various stages of caring for loved ones with dementia and the unique feelings that come with being overwhelmed and alone. Patty, through this book as well as by establishing the support group, has not only provided much-needed advice for various specific challenges during this time, but also has enabled caregivers to forge connections and obtain much-needed support. Upon meeting a new patient with memory concerns, a physician's initial role is to diagnose and treat. While there are some treatments for symptoms of such patients, there is a lack of disease-altering medications for dementia. Exercise, good nutrition, and sleep habits, among other lifestyle adjustments, are encouraged. But above all, the goal is to ensure the safety and happiness of the patient. Together with the family, medical professionals aim to identify and address potential risks for a patient, and to ensure safety at each stage of disease progression. It is, most of the time, an incredible burden for a family member to approach, and the specific challenges continue to evolve over time. And while no two patients are alike, there are similarities and common experiences among patients with dementia and their caregivers. As patients lose cognitive abilities, they often begin to feel more and more untethered to the buoy that once was their identity. And overworked caregivers, who assume the role of the life raft, can feel as if they are sinking altogether. Caregiver burnout is nearly unavoidable in supporting a patient with dementia, at least at some point during the course of a loved one's disease. Beyond Alzheimer's helps so many to feel not quite so alone. Providing this support is an invaluable resource, not only for caregivers, but the patients themselves, as they directly benefit as well. Patty has a particular ability to find the blessings and teachings in the smallest of moments, and it was both an honor as well as wonderfully touching to witness her inherent intuition and empathy. This book is a rare and special gift Patty has provided for us all by opening up about her experiences and by sharing her knowledge, so that even more families struggling with this difficult journey may find some solace. Introduction. In the end, we remember people in pieces, slivers of memory, images, bursts of sound, and trails of whispers. When I remember my father, I think of his eyes. As a child, I searched for them, wanting feverishly for them to focus on me, twinkle as they always did when he was about to say something funny or indulge one of my childish fantasies, like searching for leprechauns when the moon was full. On bright California days, his eyes seemed to match the sky. But I remember also how they could take on a mineral stillness when he was determined to teach me something important, like getting back on my horse after I fell off. I remember his shoulders, broad enough for me to sit on when I was small, strong enough to hoist me up onto a horse, build fences at our ranch. His legs were a swimmer's legs, lean and sinewy. He had perfect form when executing a dive into the pool, and his kicks when he swam were hard and athletic. When I was a child, I used to say that my father could do anything. My parents found it cute, so I said it often, but I meant it. I thought nothing could get the best of him. A lifetime later, I would watch him stand helplessly in front of a beast he could not slay. When Alzheimer's began stealing him away, his eyes were my barometer for how quickly, how relentlessly, the disease was progressing. In the early stages, they reached for what was still recognizable, sinking back into fear if what had once been familiar suddenly was not. At some point during the 10 years of his illness, he was pirated to a place far away. And the only comfort was that his eyes looked relaxed, as if it was okay to be there. Over time, they changed color, fading from blue to an uncertain shade of gray, like the sky when fog drifts across it. A week or so before he died, he closed his eyes, and I thought they would probably never open again. But they did. The night before he died, the nurse unbuttoned his pajama top to listen to his heart through the stethoscope. His shoulders were so thin, just edges of bone and pale skin. I rested my hand around his left shoulder. It fit into the curve of my palm. Then I asked the nurse if I could listen to his heartbeat. She handed me the stethoscope. "It's weak," she said, "thready." I heard it like an echo, a heart that was leaving this world, a heart I had always wanted to know better, to feel closer to. I knew I'd remember the sound for the rest of my days. Seconds before my father died, his eyes opened. They were bright blue and focused, twinkling like they once did so long ago, in a time that seemed like ancient history. He focused on my mother, let his eyelids fall again, and in an instant he was gone. In 1994, the year my family's life changed forever, people were not talking about Alzheimer's. When my father released his letter to the country and the world revealing he had been diagnosed with the disease, the Reagans suddenly became the poster family for an illness no one wanted to discuss. I was living in Manhattan at the time, and if ever I was recognized on the street, strangers would often stop me and mention his Alzheimer's. Usually they would say that they were praying for him, or that they were so sorry this had happened. But occasionally, someone would share a snippet of personal experience with a loved one who had been given the same diagnosis. It would always be brief, almost cryptic, an image through a half-open window. And then they'd be gone. I was left with glimpses into their experience, never the full story. I remember walking along Columbus Avenue one drizzly afternoon after such an encounter, and realizing that I needed to accept the fact that I was alone on a journey I knew nothing about. I felt as though I was embarking on a trek through the Himalayas without a Sherpa. I knew there would be stumbles, and times I would feel lost, but but I committed myself to embracing the passage of my father's exit from this world, whatever that would mean. Obviously, my siblings and my mother were on this journey as well. But the stark truth about Alzheimer's is that everyone loses the person who is ill in their own way, according to the architecture of their relationship with that individual. My brothers, my sister, and certainly my mother were going to lose my father in ways that were different from my loss. Even in a family that's close and communicative, it's still a pilgrim's path, and the loneliness settles deep in your bones. Almost from the start, I thought about the mysteries of memory and how we are shaped and guided by what we remember of our experiences, our history, our life lessons. All these things imprint us, mold us into the person we eventually become. So what is left if our memory is whittled away? Are we just empty vessels, a collection of cells with no identity? Some deep part of me couldn't accept that, and what came to me was the belief that would ground me during the years ahead. I didn't believe a person's soul could have Alzheimer's. I made the decision that if I kept reaching beyond the disease, if I kept aiming for my father's soul, I would somehow be able to connect with him, or I'd at least have a chance at connecting. It would, without question, be an exercise in faith. I realize some might hear this and think that this isn't for them, that as an atheist or agnostic, they don't believe in the soul being a separate entity. I am not here to proselytize. Other people's belief systems are none of my business. I would simply ask you to consider the possibility. You don't know that it's not true. And if you are facing the challenge of a loved one with any form of dementia, you're going to need all the tools you can get. Antoine de Saint-Exupéry said, "It is only with the heart that one can see rightly. What is essential is invisible to the eye." I came upon that quote shortly after my father's diagnosis, and for the many years that he spent leaving this world in stages, I held on to it like a mantra, determined to see with my heart what was invisible to my eyes. I didn't know what to expect from Alzheimer's. No one does, because every individual is different. But I knew that language would fail, that memories would turn to ash, and that no new memories would be formed. Still, I kept believing that a perfectly intact soul rested in the mysterious realm beyond cognitive thought. My father had always seemed larger than life to me, yet he carried distance with him, as if it had been encoded in his DNA. As far back as childhood, long before the glare of the world's spotlight, I sensed a mystery about him. Something out of reach that made it seem as if his path on earth was wide and important, as though he were here for far weightier tasks than parenting me. When I was in the 6th grade, he helped me build a science project on the human heart. I remember sitting beside him in the yard, the fall air sharp and cool around us, as he patiently assembled a plastic replica, complete with clear tubes for the arteries and red-dyed water for blood. As the heart came together, I wondered about his and why I couldn't get closer to it. Looking back now, I think all of us had a sense that the world was beckoning him, and he was eager to answer the call. This was one thing I had in common with my siblings. We all longed to know him better, despite the sad resignation of instinct that we never would. With Alzheimer's, he seemed to grow smaller. Everyone with the disease does. It's one of the few constants in an otherwise unpredictable illness. Holding on to the belief that his soul was unaffected allowed me to not get lost in the diminishment of his physical being. I saw it, mourned what was being stolen, but I clung to the confidence that his soul was deep, fathomless, and no illness could intrude upon it. I didn't know it then, but the seeds were being planted for the support group program I would start many years later, a group for caregivers and family members of people with dementia, the program I would call Beyond Alzheimer's. After my father died, I thought for a while that my time with Alzheimer's was over, that its hold on me had been broken. And I would look back on it as a chapter of my life, one in which I had changed and grown. I didn't see it as an experience that would chart the course of my life going forward in many ways. How naive of me, I think now. What happened was other eyes started to tug at me. They were the eyes of strangers who would occasionally stop me in grocery stores or on the sidewalk. They would share with me personal details of what they were going through with Alzheimer's, or one of the other versions of dementia. They would tell me about a father or a mother, sometimes a spouse, who they could no longer reach, who no longer knew them, who had either gradually or suddenly stopped recognizing them. Sometimes their eyes brimmed with tears. Other times their eyes were wide and unblinking, as if they were too exhausted to cry. Always they seemed haunted. Alzheimer's drifts in through an unlocked door and proceeds to steal what is most valuable, a human being. You're helpless against it. You have no choice but to accept that you're its prisoner, too. I started to notice that when I listened to people who I didn't know and might never see again, when I offered some insights or realizations from my years with Alzheimer's, their eyes changed. Often it was just a slight shift, a leaning away from despair towards something that felt like hope. Hope that the prison walls weren't as solid as they seemed. Hope that dementia wasn't the whole story. That there were hidden chambers past their loved one's ruined memory and broken language where the person they once knew could still be glimpsed. One woman in the cereal aisle at Whole Foods started crying and said, "Thank you. I haven't let myself cry enough. It's all bottled up in me." I had told her to not listen to the unlinked words her mother was uttering. Word salad, it's come to be called. But listen instead to the rise and fall of her voice, the tone, the emotional waves beneath the words. She probably still wouldn't know exactly what her mother was trying to communicate, but she'd get the emotional underpinnings, and from those she could fashion a response. "Sometimes it helps if you don't look at her," I told the woman. "Look away and just absorb her voice." The way I came to that discovery is quirky and a bit unusual. One day, when I was intensely focused on my father, trying and failing to understand what he was saying, a memory popped into my mind. Many years earlier, in the 80s, I had spent an evening with John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd in New York. John abandoned us early, and Dan and his girlfriend drove me back to their apartment. At one moment in their living room, he was talking about something. I don't remember what now. But I couldn't figure out if he was joking or serious. I said to his girlfriend, "How do you know when he's joking?" "Oh, it's easy," she told me. "Just don't look at him." That memory stayed with me, and it surfaced right when I needed it. It was how I figured out that if I didn't look at my father, the clues to what he was trying to say would be there in the cadence of his voice. As lonely as my odyssey with Alzheimer's was, I'm actually grateful for the solitariness of the journey. I got to map things out for myself, with no one telling me I was wrong or crazy or off base. Since people weren't talking about the disease, there was no temptation to call someone and say, for example, "I made this great discovery based on an evening I spent with Dan Aykroyd a long time ago. What do you think?" I can only imagine what the reaction would have been. But the truth was, when I trusted my instinct, when I relied on that particular memory and put it into practice, it worked. Occasionally a stranger would slip in something about a parent who didn't have Alzheimer's, but was the caregiver, and mentioned how difficult that was. The comments were usually punctuated by long sighs, telegraphing exhaustion and exasperation. I would think afterward about how complicated it could sometimes be with my mother during the decade of my father's illness. I wanted to be a daughter who knew how to comfort, offer solace. My mother was, after all, losing the love of her life. But the language of my family was one of distance and fractures and trepidation. I had to learn a new language and try it out in an environment where it might not be accepted. My mother had frightened me for my entire life. I would have to reach past that fear in order to offer comfort. There were moments when I think I got it right, but there were many other times when fear stopped me. Ultimately, I learned another important lesson. As much as Alzheimer's, and the person who has it, comes to dominate your life, it also presents you with an opportunity to free yourself from the domination of the past. The dynamics that were once in place don't need to define the future. I'd spent so many decades longing for what I was never going to get from my parents. Alzheimer's made me realize that I had to be the one to change. A friend of mine told me how she had been regaling her therapist with all the ways she had tried and was still trying to elicit tenderness from her mother, a woman who had never shown any. The therapist finally said to her, "Why do you keep going to the hardware store for bread?" It was a brilliant description of what many of us do. I resolved to stop looking for what I wasn't going to find and pay close attention to what was there. By 2001, I had been doing lectures for several years. At events and various gatherings, I spoke about being the daughter of someone with Alzheimer's and what I was learning from the experience. I had a lecture date in Michigan, booked for mid-September, which had been set many months earlier. Then 9/11 happened. As a nation, we were driven to our knees, numb with shock and ragged with grief. I remember, as we all do, the silent skies and the pall of sadness everywhere. I had no idea if planes would start flying again in time for my lecture, and frankly, I was kind of hoping they wouldn't. Not only did I not want to get on a plane, I didn't know how to fit in the devastation we were all going through with the subject matter I was expected to talk about. And I felt I had to include it. I couldn't ignore what was uppermost in everyone's thoughts. As it turned out, planes did resume flying a couple of days before my lecture date. The talk I gave so soon after the towers fell focused more on grief than I had in other lectures. And then I brought up the question that was gripping all of us. Why? Why was such unimaginable evil sent our way? Why were those who died in the towers or in the planes present at that time when there were other people who, at the last minute, stopped for coffee or took a day off or changed flights and lived because of that one small choice? Why does a good, kind person get Alzheimer's when someone down the road who is mean and dishonest and yells at the neighborhood kids is enjoying perfect health? Where is the sense in all this? Or is it all just random? I told those who had come to listen to me that I had no answer for any of those questions, and people much wiser than I don't have answers either. It's a question that can never be answered. Not on this side of life, anyway. A far better question is, what can I learn from this? If you say to yourself, "I don't understand this, I can't make sense out of it, but I'm willing to be open to whatever lessons are folded into this situation," then you change your experience of the experience, at least in small ways. It seemed to register with the people I was speaking to. And I realized I was also saying it to try to keep myself on a path of learning and staying open. I needed to reinforce it in myself. It's not easy when life slams into you and you find yourself struggling through grief. It's hard to let go of asking why, of trying to make sense out of what makes no sense. With Alzheimer's, with a devastating experience like 9/11, with any overwhelming tragedy, there are no visible markers to guide us through the fog. When pilots can't see where they're going because of clouds or fog, they rely on instruments. We have internal instruments, strengths we didn't realize we had, insights, faith, all of which can help pull us through. That lecture date has stayed with me, not only because of when it was, but because I looked out at people with their arms around a companion, or maybe a stranger, I couldn't be sure, and I thought about the sweetness of grief, and how it can heal us in times of great wound and stunning loss. I looked out at faces that were streaked with tears, but that had a resolve, a determination to go on despite the pain. It was a lesson in the power and beauty of shared sorrow. A group of people came out to listen to someone else's experience with a disease that had upended their lives. I learned from the question and answer portion about the young mother whose father couldn't remember from one visit to the next who the little baby was that his daughter was holding. She wanted her father to be able to hold his grandson, but she was too afraid he would drop the baby. I learned about the wife whose husband no longer recognized her, and the man who now bathed his father in the tub, talking to him as if he were a child. Everyone there had a story that they carried with them, woke up to each morning, and wept over most nights. And then there was the bigger story linking us all. Planes into the towers. Thousands of people dead on a bright blue morning. A day that made us wonder if hate was winning, and if we would ever heal. What I saw in that crowd on that day was that the gentleness of grief was winning. I saw that while the details of everyone's story differed, their pain flowed from love. In the time following my father's death, pulled by the words of strangers, I couldn't shake the feeling that my story wasn't unique. The wounds and scars in family can feel isolating, until you realize you are part of a very large club. Our stories are usually more alike than different. I knew there were countless caregivers wrestling with the same things I'd wrestled with. And while I learned a lot from the solitariness of my experience, I wanted to try to lessen the loneliness of others who were going through the same thing. Someone once told me that there are two types of people in the world— those who go through a door and never turn around to see if someone's behind them, and those who hold the door open in case there is. I wanted to be in the latter category. I'm not sure why it took me 8 years after my father's death to start my support group, Beyond Alzheimer's. Maybe it simply took that long for me to organize within myself all that I had learned. Or it could be that I needed those years to recognize that once Alzheimer's enters your life, it never really leaves. For the decade of my father's illness, I felt as if I were floating in the deep end, tossed by waves, carried by currents, but not drowning. My lifelines were my faith, and a stubborn resolve to look past the cruelty of the disease in order to learn from it. At some point, I saw how Alzheimer's was actually enabling me to know my father a bit better. Apertures opened up. I got to see glimpses of the boy who raced into his house after school, pulled his ice skates out from under the bed, and skated on the river until the light started fading, and his mother called to him from the back door. I got to see the athletic teenager who refused to let his acute nearsightedness hamper him. He was a lifeguard in the summers and rescued 77 people, a fact that not even Alzheimer's could remove from his memory. I got to see the young man who dreamed of a bigger life than the one his parents had, who loved his father and learned tolerance and fairness from him, but who pledged to be nothing like him in other ways. Jack Reagan had long been a hostage to alcohol, Success for him was always an out-of-reach dream sitting at the bottom of a whiskey glass. Alzheimer's moves a person back through time. If you're willing to follow them down that road, you can learn things you might never have learned otherwise.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?